Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for joining Dr. Perletta Ramos and Raj Shell in Living Life Powerfully. We help you turn the ordinary into the extraordinary by claiming your power, getting your heart in the game, and learning how to live from the inside out. Let's create more happiness and success in your life.
Last night, a special episode of Vice on HBO aired. It went deep into the American prison system, along with President Obama and former Attorney General Eric Holder. The show addressed the problem of substance abuse and incarceration rates in the U.S. You see, the U.S. has the distinction of having the highest incarceration rates in the world. In 2012, nearly 7 million adults were involved with the criminal justice system, that being the state or federal system, with prisons or local jails, and another 5 million were under probation or parole supervision. That's according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. During the show, the president discussed many things, among them being the need for substance abuse treatment in prison. Substance abuse of alcohol, tobacco, and illicit drugs is costly to the United States. According to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, it costs more than $700 billion annually, related to crime, lost work productivity, and health care. Drug addiction is actually considered a mental illness. Many people don't know that. Addiction changes the brain in fundamental ways. It disturbs how a person's normal hierarchy of needs and desires work, their sense of priorities, such that in many cases when the addiction gets more severe, there is a fixation or desire to just procure or obtain the drugs that they're seeking. And that can result in compulsive behaviors that weaken the ability to determine their impulse control, right? Despite the negative consequences, that's why when we sometimes see people engage in, antisocial behavior, we wonder why. And it's that impulse control just to acquire the drug that happened. But I am not here to just talk about that. Today we have Akusua McCray as a guest on our show. Ms. McCray is a substance abuse counselor with 15 years' experience working with inmates at the Durango Jail. Currently, she works as an ALPHA counselor for Maricopa County Sheriff's Office under the direction of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Welcome to the show today, Ms. McCray.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good.
Now, I mentioned just briefly in the introduction that you work for Sheriff Joe Arpaio, a man who sees himself as America's toughest sheriff. How did you come to work in the jails as a substance abuse counselor?
Well, it's kind of a long story, actually. I was working as a juvenile detention officer for a while, and after I had finished working on my master's degree, it just kind of evolved. I ended up going for an interview, and after a 7 to 11 shift in the morning, thinking that I probably wouldn't get the job because I was kind of disheveled and tired, and so obviously I got the job, and here I am. I kind of fell into substance abuse. It wasn't something that I really thought about doing.
And yet you stayed there for more than 15 years. Tell us why.
Well, part of it is the team that I work for and the people that I work with. There's a very dedicated team of professionals that work in this program, and we all believe in what we do. And you know, it's been an incredible journey for the last 15 years. Not just my coworkers, but also the people that I work with. And I've learned an awful lot from them, and it's just been a really growing journey for me.
Now, President Obama mentioned yesterday on the program the positive influence of prevention and or substance abuse treatment and helping those who are incarcerated to not recede back into the system. And there's also scientific research that suggests, actually from the mid-1970s, that drug abuse treatment can help drug abusing offenders change their attitudes, their beliefs, their behaviors towards drug abuse, and they can help them avoid relapses. And then also, like President Obama indicated, it can help them reduce recidivism. Can you talk a little bit about the substance abuse program that you work with in Maricopa County?
Yes, ALPHA started in 1996. Joel Pryor started the program in 1996, so we're coming up on our 20th year anniversary. And it was originally started for women in the women's jail. And we had one group of, I can't remember how many women there were there because I wasn't there at that time, but we started with the women and then gradually brought in the men. And the recidivism, it does help with the recidivism. We have a motto, which is ALPHA. We become aware of our life issues. We learn how to cope with them. We plan to continue and improve our future. We seek the help we need, and we accept ourselves today as we improve for tomorrow. The program is a comprehensive 14 weeks right now. We have, along with counseling, they have an anger management, domestic violence, parenting class. We have Maricopa County workforce that come in and talk to them about working once they get released. We have an ALPHA transitional program, which helps them once they are released, they can get continued counseling through the ALPHA program. We have social workers that come in and work with them and, you know, help them with getting situated once they get out of jail. So it's an all-round program. And, you know, we have some stuff that's going to be happening in the future. We're having drug education for people that are in jail but don't have time to do the ALPHA program. That's going to be coming online soon. And also substance abuse programming for the juveniles that are being charged as adults that are in the jail, too.
So can you tell a little bit about what your typical day is like working with the inmates in the program?
Well, typical day, let's see. For me, it's not as busy as it is for them. Currently we are about to graduate, I think about 40 males on Wednesday from the program. So I have about 12 gentlemen in my group at the moment that are about to graduate. So I would typically spend 2.5 hours a day with them 4 days a week. And then the rest of the day, they're in other programming. We have a yoga class that they have on Thursday mornings. And so the rest of the day, my day is spent, you know, working on looking at the program, looking at the curriculum, talking with my peers, writing, you know, notes, that kind of thing.
In addition to the yoga class, what other types of things do they do in the program? I know you mentioned a number of items for in terms of domestic violence and workforce development, but the actual curriculum of what they're learning beyond yoga, which sounds somewhat relaxing. We talked about that in a second, but what else are they exposed to in the program?
Well, there's a program called T4C, which is Thinking for a Change. And that was developed some years ago for probationers. And we brought it into the jail, and that is, I think, a 24-week program where they get ready to, it helps them with their thinking. It's very cognitive. In fact, the entire program is a cognitive program, although, you know, each of the counselors that work with the inmates have their own theoretical background that they come with. But the program is basically cognitive, and it's evidence-based. And we are about to start a new curriculum, actually, and to try that out to see how that goes. But it also addresses criminogenic thinking. So there's not an awful lot of other stuff that goes on besides the programming. They are housed separately from the general population, so they are in their own housing area. So they, you know, they have to adhere to all the rules and the regulations that are in the program too. But there's less of them in the housing area, so that, you know, we're trying to encourage also, you know, to them to be socially adept, if you want to call it that. But yeah, so there's, you know, there's most of the day they're in programming, and that's what's happening.
Okay, now I believe the statistics show that there's a relationship between drug use and crime, and you just gave us.
I can't hear what you're saying.
I said the statistics show us there's a relationship between drug use and crime, and you just talked about the program generally. Can you speak now to who your typical client or inmate is?
I don't think there is a typical client or inmate. Substance abuse affects everybody. You know, I mean, it can be, I worked with a lady once who had been married for 35 years, and her husband one day decided that he didn't want to be married anymore, and he left, and she began drinking to help her sleep, and the next thing she knew, she was in jail. So there is no real typical client. I mean, a drug addict isn't there on the streets, you know, just shaking and jittery and everything, but the stereotype that we get, I mean, it could be anybody. Firefighters, we've had firefighters, police officers, we've had, you know, football stars, of course, you know, just anybody. This disease knows no boundaries.
I think that's a very powerful statement, because quite often we, when we look at the news media, we see a particular type of person as being a drug addict, and yet drugs isn't just, like you said, a particular, it doesn't affect one particular person or a segment of the community, it affects everyone. And there's a proliferation of, at least now, drug use, as I've been reading, related to prescription medication. So it doesn't necessarily just include crack and cocaine and methamphetamine. What types if you've got to study this or maintain some tracking, are there types of substances that are more common that you see that people are addicted to in the ALPHA program?
Or
well, in ALPHA, it's prescription drugs, yes, definitely are up there, but mostly a lot of my clients is methamphetamine and marijuana are the two biggest ones, and heroin following behind. Those are the three main ones. Of course, you know, we often see in the news the damage and the problems that methamphetamine causes. So I think that's probably one of the biggest problems in the Valley right now.
Now, a 2004 survey by the U.S. Department of Justice estimated that about 70% of state and 64% of federal prisoners regularly use drugs prior to incarceration. And the study also showed that 1 in 4 violent offenders in state prisons committed their offenses under the influence of drugs. Can you tell us why, from your experience listening to inmates, why they have such a high drug use prior to coming into the penal system?
Well, that's a difficult question, because it varies for everybody. I mean, it has a lot to do with, I think, you know, from my experience, is coping. And, you know, when you have an individual who, you know, has a traumatic childhood I'm talking about reasons, not excuses here, that they, how one person copes with something is different from how another person copes. So it's really hard to say why people get involved in drugs and alcohol and become addicted. And not everybody does become addicted. There are those that are out there that, you know, can use recreationally and stay under the radar. They never get caught. So there's a lot of factors that you know, you have to take into account when you're looking at somebody becoming addicted. It has to do with brain chemistry. It has to do with genetics. It has to do with, the environment that they come from. There's a lot of variables.
So when
you can't really say.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say you can't really say who is going to become addicted.
When you're helping to teach them coping skills, though, and taking into account what you just said, that there are, you know, genetic factors and a whole host of other things that may interplay with why they choose to engage in substance as a coping mechanism. How do you teach them how to cope while they're in prison? What are you teaching them that helps them to make different choices?
Well, to quote Dr. Wayne Dyer, it's change your thoughts, you change your life. So that's basically where it's at. It's the way they think. And cognitively, you know, to really get them to start thinking differently about themselves, about their lives, about, you know, their potential even. We do a lot of motivational interviewing to really get them to start to think about themselves differently. It's a process, though, and it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. And the most important part, I think, also for them is once they are released, it's not so much them getting sober, it's staying sober that is the issue. Once they get out, you know, if they don't have the support that they need to, you know, to continue in sobriety, you know, that's why the recidivism rate, you know, is so high. Although for the program for Alpha, I think it's about a third less of the recent statistics are telling me that, you know, that with the for both sexes of the people that are participating in Alpha, there's at least about a 20% lower recidivism rate than the general population. So something is working, you know, somewhere along the line. For every one person that we send out of there that doesn't come back, that's a triumph, at least for me as a counselor.
I would imagine that it is. So, based upon just what you said, why do you think that the recidivism rate is so high nationally? And I know it's lower in the Alpha program, but why do you think people end up coming back beyond the coping? I mean, is it?
I think it has to do with, like I just said, that, you know, once they get out of jail, if the resources and the services are not there for them to transition back into the community. I mean, we're looking at people that have felonies on their records. A lot of places, they can't find, you know, work. They can't find places to live. I mean, it's if they don't have a support system in family, pretty doomed. So it's really about the communities coming together, and that's what we are really trying to do. We have a lot of community partners that help with the Alpha program to help them to transition back into the community and to become productive citizens.
So there are a couple of things that you mentioned that I find quite compelling. One of them, earlier on, you mentioned the yoga program, and then you quoted Wayne Dyer, and you talked about how you helped to shift their thinking. And you used motivation, or I believe the word was motivation. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Motivational interviewing. Well, it's really, for me, my approach is more on a positive vein. I really try hard not to beat them around the head with their addiction. And we come in and we, with the group therapy, we talk a lot about, you know, their future potential. You know, what do they have? What's going on in their life right now that is good? We talk a lot about gratitude. We talk a lot about forgiveness, those kinds of things, to really, you know, to help them start to believe in themselves a little bit. You know, if there's somebody out there that actually believes in them, and every single one of my colleagues that works in this program comes into that program with that belief that people can change and, you know, we believe in them. And that's the way we have to approach it. And so we try to motivate them as best we can with what we have. I mean, obviously there's limited resources. We're in a jail, and the jail is a very transient population, and so it's not like a prison. It's a little different. And so people are always coming and going. And so, you know, it's a different atmosphere. It's not as stable as it is in a prison. So Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And it sounds like within the prison, you and your colleagues create an atmosphere of support, which is critical. But as you mentioned, the program is only a 14-week program. So how can our listeners best understand a person who is addicted to drugs in terms of what can be done on the outside to help them once they're released?
Well, that's kind of difficult. I think that the biggest thing would be not to enable. I've lost two brothers to this disease, and I know that my mother was a big enabler. When my brother would come home and she wanted to support him, she would, take care of him. And I think that that's one of the big things, that they need to take responsibility for their own lives. I mean, having support is one thing, but for somebody to give all the time to them without, them taking any responsibility, I think that's one of the biggest things. Like, for instance, if they're not working or they're not looking for work and, you're taking care of them, you're feeding them, clothing them or whatever, that doesn't give them any incentive to get out there and start to take care of themselves. So I think, for me, the biggest thing is not to enable their behavior and to really be honest and upfront with them about, how they feel about certain things instead of working on eggshells around them.
Mm. That's interesting. I've had a family member or two that have had significant substance abuse problems, and that almost feels like the opposite of what you want to do, right? You want to be able to help them, and you think they're suffering, right? They're challenged, and you want to come to their aid. So how do you balance wanting to be supportive with enabling? Where do you draw the line with that? If you have a family member who's homeless or who doesn't have enough food to eat or, who's struggling.
I think that, there are so many services that are available in Phoenix. I think that, if family members could become more, I think you have to become a little bit like a social worker and, look for places for them. There's a lot of halfway houses and places where they can stay until they become more stable. And, I would definitely advocate for helping them to, get into a halfway house, maybe get into another program, an aftercare program, or even into treatment, initial treatment. Some people prefer to have their family member at home, and sometimes that can be difficult if they're still, in the throes of their addiction. But, once they have some sobriety, they've got, they've got their foot out there and they're actually working a program, I think, to bring them home and to support them from there is a good thing. But in the initial stages, I think they really, even though they need your support there, they also need to start to be thinking about, being self-sufficient too.
I know you mentioned you had two brothers that have had a substance abuse problem. You lost them to substance abuse. Other than that, what experience has prepared you for what you do right now?
Prepared me? I don't think anything could really prepare you other than, a good academic program. And we have ongoing training in our program in the jail. We have, a really great clinical director and program coordinator who constantly are, supporting us and training us. Also our division commander and the supporting commander are also very supportive of us and our program. So I think it's not so much that we're prepared, we're just really supported I can't really speak for my colleagues, but for myself, I have a lot of things that I do after work, different things that I do to help myself. Yoga has become a very big part of my life, and I also have several different hobbies that I like to do that, help me to just transition from my work to my own life. It's very easy to become burned out in this field if you're not careful. And I also, you know, have my own counselor that I go and see, you know, every couple of weeks or so. I go and see somebody if I'm having issues so that I don't throw those issues into the classroom with me.
So you mentioned that it's easy to get burned out. Can you say a little bit more about that? Well, is it because of being in the jail or the type of population or the type of work that you're doing? What specifically can lead to burnout from your perspective?
I think burnout, it's a lot of things. You know, I mean, sometimes, there are things, our hands are tied with, you know, we have budget restraints sometimes. Sometimes we don't have the staff that we need. So it's really working around those things, along with working with the population that we work with. I can't say that it's I feel endangered because we have awesome officers that work with us. So we're never. I mean, you can't really say that you're not in any danger at all. But it's very, very minimal. We are very well taken care of by the officers that also work in the program. So the burnout, you know, comes from not taking care of self, I think. And I think it's really, really important that you really do take care of yourself, because if you don't take care of yourself, you can't really take care of anybody else. And so we get significant breaks in between each cycle. So we'll have 6 weeks of what we call pre-alpha, where we see, for us as the counselors, we see them for twice a week. And then we take a break for 2 or 3 weeks while we do paperwork and they have different vendors that come in and do presentations for them. And then we'll have another 6 weeks of intense programming. And that's 4 days a week. And the counselors, like I said, see them for 2.5 hours a day. So, you know, the breaks that are built in to the program help us to gather our thoughts and prepare for the next group that we're going to do. So I think that it's a little different on the if you're working in an agency, because it's ongoing all the time. There's never any breaks. So working in the jail is a little different. So the burnout isn't quite as bad. I mean, my colleagues that I've worked with them for years. I mean, the oldest colleague that I have, he's been there a couple of years longer than me, and I've been there 16 years. And, you know, typically counselors move around quite a bit because of burnout. But here we seem to be very fixed.
Well, based on the longevity, one would say you're getting some gratification from your work. Can you talk a little bit about what you enjoy about it?
Well, I think it's part of it is the team that I work with, the team of dedicated professionals who have also several of whom are also personal friends, and I think the clients that I call them clients. Mates, but I call them clients because I have to think about them a little differently because I'm giving them, you know, I'm wanting to motivate them. And so I think that each group is very different. The dynamics are very different. And I have been privileged to meet some really amazing people in the last 16 years, despite the fact that they have these problems and these issues with the substances. There are some very talented, articulate people that come through here that you would not even imagine would be an addict if you went by the typical stereotype of what an addict is. So I learn a lot from them also. It's just a really good feeling to be able to be a part of somebody's life and help them to gain some perspective, you know, on what's going on.
I thank you so much for joining us today on Living Life Powerfully. Next week, feel free to join us where we'll discuss the differences between meditation and prayer. Ms. McCray, thank you so much for being our guest today. Between
thank
now
you.
And next week, please feel free to reach us at pearlrajradio@gmail.com and make sure to like our Facebook page, Living Life Powerfully, for the latest updates. Stay true to yourself and stay empowered.